From the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Well, good afternoon. Not Tony Perkins today. Eben Fowler from Bot Radio Network filling in for Tony. Tony is cruising somewhere in Alaska as of this moment, but we're going to be hearing from him in the second segment. I'll tell you about that here in just a second. In just a moment, though, not only did the networks and MSNBC censor President Trump's salute to America on the 4th of July in front of the Lincoln Memorial, but some liberal media pundits claimed that no other presidents had spoken on Independence Day. I've got lots of audio you won't want to miss, along with Tim Graham of the Media Research Center, for his analysis. In my second segment, as I mentioned, Tony Perkins himself will be joining us from the Family Research Council Alaskan Cruise to talk about the State Department's formation of a Commission on Unalienable Rights. That was announced this morning by Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. Tony was well aware that announcement was coming out, and so that's why he's taking the time today to call us from Alaska. Wish I was there, but not got to hold down the fort here, sort of hold the ship down, if you will, for him. At the bottom of the hour, I'll be talking about Amazon's decision to ban books by the late Dr. Joseph Nicolosi. He helped people overcome unwanted same-sex attraction, and that the ban on the books came after pressure from homosexual activists, if you can imagine that. Peter Sprigg is FRC's Senior Fellow of Policy Studies, and he'll join me for that segment. Then in my final segment, I'll talk about a new book called Justice on Trial, the Kavanaugh Confirmation, and the Future of the Supreme, with authors Molly Hemingway and Carrie Severino. You won't want to miss that segment because they're going to tell us about some of the behind-the-scenes things that took place during that hearing. And if you were following that at all, it was kind of a horrendous the way they treated Mr. Kavanaugh. It got to the point of being actually quite silly. And this segment, the last segment of the broadcast, I think you'll find very interesting. So stay with us. And then, of course, we will take your calls, try to squeeze in a few calls during that segment as well. Well, in a move that's not really all that shocking, considering how the mainstream media feels about Donald Trump, MSNBC, CBS, NBC, and ABC decided not to carry the president's 4th of July Salute to America speech. However, despite their claim that President Trump would politicize Independence Day, his speech was demonstrably nonpartisan. I've got a couple of sound bites here for you. The first one we're going to play is the open to his speech. That's the first cut. Go ahead, Bobby.
243 years ago, our founding fathers pledged their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor to declare independence and defend our God-given rights. That same American spirit that emboldened our founders has kept us strong throughout our history. To this day, that spirit runs through the veins of every American patriot.
And here's his inspirational and, may I add, nonpartisan close.
We will always be the people who defeated a tyrant, crossed the continent, harnessed science, took to the skies, and soared into the heavens. Because we will never forget that we are Americans and the future belongs to us. We are one people chasing one dream and one magnificent destiny. We all share the same heroes, the same home, the same heart, and we are all made by the same Almighty God.
Well, that sounds fairly partisan, don't you think? I don't think so. You know, and I found it interesting. Actually, during that time, I was unable to watch the event, but I was able to listen to it on the radio. And I thought it was interesting because I first listened to Fox, and they were carrying the event. They carried it live. And actually, they had a full 2-hour special devoted to carrying that. And then CNN did carry part of it. Don't know how much because I was just popping back and forth. But one of the things that I found quite interesting, I happened to tune in just before the point when both Fox and CNN broke away for commentary from the people on the set at that time. And to listen to the two of them, I found the contrast almost unbelievable. it was as if they were commenting on two completely different events. The CNN people were looking for everything that they could to try to make it as negative as possible, and to, as is sort of the par for the course every day, every night for 24 hours, unless they're reporting on an earthquake. You know, they were just looking for ways to bash the president, and almost comparing the presence of a couple of military pieces of equipment to Tiananmen Square in China. And you know what happened there, and the military flyovers. But then flipping back to Fox's commentary, just a completely different kind of a situation there. So, once again, there are certain organizations that used to be news organizations that really have lost complete credibility. I listen to them only for entertainment, just so I can. In fact, when I listen to MSNBC, which is probably totals about 90 seconds a week, if that, almost every time before I push the button, I say, OK, let's see what the crazies have to say, because regardless of time of day or night, it seems that they are trying to criticize the current administration. So anyway, that's the way that goes. Our intent is to have a guest on here. His name is Tim Graham. He's with the Media Research Center, and our producer, Bobby, is working hard to try to get him on the line. So until that time, we'll do our best to kind of cover it here. So I've got a couple of other audio clips here, actually several, and I'm going to play two of them back to back. The first one is good old Chris Matthews from MSNBC. And this is from Hardball. The first cut is going to be from Hardball. And he went as far as to predict that unruly Republicans would clash with Democrats during the festivities. And that's going to be followed directly by another cut from Maggie Haberman. Maggie is a New York Times White House correspondent, and she's also a CNN analyst. And she said the speech would look like a presidential rally rather than a celebration of America. So let's listen to those two cuts together. First, Chris Matthews, and then Maggie Haberman.
They're going to have their Confederate flags flying and their license plates and all kinds of troublemaking. There'll be a lot of other people that are going to meet like in a storm, and you're going to have a real conflict.
You will hear criticism of his critics. You will hear a celebration of self.
Well, I guess both of them, were sad to get it so badly wrong. And I just want to contrast that with a clip from Corey Lewandowski. He was a former Trump campaign manager. And this is a clip from Fox and Friends from July 5th. And he said that the speech, again, this is President Trump's speech, put the country above all else. Here's Corey Lewandowski.
He has restored the values that we have held dear for so many years. Our dominance overseas, us being proud that our family members have served in the military, remembering our heritage, remembering the people who came before us. That's what the president talked about yesterday.
So, again, Corey might be a little bit partisan because he worked with President Trump during the campaign. But as I was listening to the commentary from both Fox and CNN, I didn't have the courage to flip over to MSNBC at that time because I knew what I was going to get. And, you heard here from what Mr. Matthews said. That's just kind of nuttiness that took place there. And there were claims that no other president had spoken on the 4th of July. So apparently the folks that said those kinds of things didn't really spend a whole lot of time doing, any research whatsoever. So what I'd like to do here, in fact, here, Eugene Robinson claimed that presidents don't speak on the 4th of July. I've got a couple of examples here. Here's the first one. It's Ronald Reagan. Let's play that cut.
In a few moments, the celebration will begin here in New York Harbor. It's going to be quite a show. I was just looking over the preparations and thinking about a saying that we had back in Hollywood about never doing a scene with kids or animals. They steal the scene every time. So you can rest assured, I wouldn't even think about trying to compete with a fireworks display, especially on the 4th of July.
And here in just a second, we're going to play a clip from former President Obama. But first, since we don't have a guest, I just want to put our phone number out there at 866-372-7234. And Bobby, you'll have to jump around a little bit here. But what I'd like to do is if you happen to watch this Salute to America, the 4th of July event from Washington, D.C., I'd love to hear from you and like to hear what your impressions were of it. You've heard my impressions and the impressions of a couple of commentators. But let's get some folks jumping on the line here to help fill our time out in this first segment. 866-372-7234. We'd love to hear from you. And let's go ahead and play this clip from President Obama.
Happy 4th of July. Michelle and I are honored and proud to have you here on the 4th. And we're humbled to be joined up here by heroes, men and women who went beyond the call of duty in battle.
Very good. So, you know, Eugene Robinson said that presidents don't speak on the 4th of July. I think I just heard former President Obama speaking on the 4th of July. So, all right, we have our guest on the line now, Tim Graham. Yeah, let me see if I can find his intro information here. Tim, are you on the line with us?
Yes, sir.
All right. Glad you could join us. Well, we listened to some sound bites from Chris Matthews and Maggie Haberman and then contrasted that with Corey Lewandowski. Just listened to Presidents Reagan and Obama speaking on the 4th of July. What's your take on how the media covered or maybe didn't cover this?
Well, I think they decided that it was going to be a campaign rally before they actually knew what was going to happen. And they went beyond that to this sort of wild talk that they love to do about how somehow the president of the United States is like a North Korean dictator because he wants to speak on the 4th of July. So, I mean, yeah, there's a whole bunch of quotes of these people. We made a video. Our Bill D'Agostino made a video of all of these people saying it's going to be a campaign rally. He's going to make the 4th of July all about him. And, of course, anybody who watched it knows that's not what happened at all.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, as I said earlier before you jumped on the line here, there were a number of folks who were making claims, such as the fact, or what they considered a fact, that no president had spoken on the 4th of July before that. Now, it's so easy these days in the age of the internet and, you know, being able to search on DuckDuckGo or Bing or, you know, even Google if you use that thing, that it's easy to find out that that's not true. So why are these people who, you know, we're supposed to be paying attention to, why are they saying things that are completely wrong?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good point, which is, reporters are supposed to be the most industrious, the most careful with facts, and they said things here. It's one thing to, you know, when you're comparing Trump to Kim Jong-un, you're just, you know, you're just speculating wildly. But to claim that presidents never speak on the 4th of July is wrong.
Well, I mean, what does it say? And we've got about 30 seconds here, but what does it say about the current state of the Fourth Estate, the media?
Well, I think this whole experience underlines that the hatred gets ahead of everything else.
And that's really sad. That's really sad. Well, Tim, I'm glad you were able to join us. Tim Graham from the Media Research Center. Well, you're listening to Washington Watch. Eben Fowler with Bot Radio Network filling in for Tony Perkins today. Coming up next, Tony Perkins himself joins us from the Family Research Council, Alaskan Cruise. He's going to talk about the State Department's formation of a Commission on Unalienable Rights. That's right after this break here on Washington Watch.
Can United States senators interrogate court nominees on their religious beliefs? This is a controversial question that our country is facing today. In light of this controversy, FRC has taken up the task of answering this question with one of their latest publications, Rebels Without a Clause. We've seen in recent Senate confirmation hearings a troubling pattern arise where senators have begun questioning presidential nominees about their faith as an attempt to discredit them. These interrogations have gone so far as to asking nominees of their theological beliefs church membership, and associations with faith-based nonprofits. It has been an alarming display of hostility toward religion and people of faith. Visit frc.org/test to learn what questioning the Constitution's No Religious Test Clause allows and forbids in the process of confirming judicial nominees. That's frc.org/test.
The latest Trojan horse on Capitol Hill is called the Equality Act. The way the left is advertising this bill is misleading because it does not further equality at all. It would actually violate current protections in place that allow private institutions and people of faith to freely act in accordance to their deeply held beliefs. The Equality Act explicitly removes religious liberty protections that were originally put in place with bipartisan support. Its stated goal is equality, but its actual result is harm to vast members of communities, individuals, and Americans as a whole by undercutting our foundational freedom of religion. Is this really what equality looks like? A more fitting name for the Equality Act would be the Inequality Act. For more information on the mass threat of the Equality Act, visit frc.org/EqualityAct2019. That's frc.org/EqualityAct2019.
Many advances made by the homosexual movement are based on the claim that sexual orientation is immutable or unchangeable. This belief was a deciding factor in the 2015 Supreme Court case that redefined marriage to include same-sex couples. It has been a key argument for LGBT activists fighting to restrict or ban therapies for people seeking help to overcome their same-sex attraction. But is sexual orientation written in stone? Should we brand people with an immovable sexual orientation label and tell them, you can't change, don't try to change, even if they want to? In a new publication from FRC, we reveal that sexual orientation can change. Survey data shows that heterosexuality is largely stable, but homosexuality is not. Even pro-LGBT scholars are calling for the immutability argument to be abandoned. The question is, why is the LGBT movement pushing this false argument? To learn more, visit frc.org/sexualorientation. That's frc.org/sexualorientation.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. Eben Fowler with Bot Radio Network, filling in for Tony Perkins, who's actually my next guest in the midst of the Family Research Council Alaskan Cruise. Be talking with Tony here in just a minute. And he wanted to comment on this brand new news. So that's why we got him on the line. Well, this morning, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo announced the creation of the Commission on Unalienable Rights. Pompeo said that while nations misuse the term human right, the commission is meant to create impactful discourse across the world. Let's listen to what he had to say.
We must, therefore, be vigilant that human rights discourse not be corrupted or hijacked or used for dubious or malignant purposes. It's a sad commentary on our times that more than 70 years after the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, gross violations continue throughout the world, sometimes even in the name of human rights.
And Pompeo said another purpose of the commission is to answer one paramount question. Here's cut two.
Is it in fact true, as our Declaration of Independence asserts, that as human beings, we, all of us, every member of our human family are endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights?
Well, the Secretary of State explained that the commission, quote, will provide the intellectual grist of what I hope will be one of the most profound reexaminations of unalienable rights in the world since the 1948 Universal Declaration that he just referred to. Joining me now, live from the Family Research Council Alaskan Cruise, is FRC's President Tony Perkins. Thanks for taking some time to explain the full import of this commission. And by the way, how is Alaska today?
Well, we just left Seattle last night, so on our way, just the first day underway at sea, but having a great time already with a number of FRC supporters, a number of bot listeners as well that are on the cruise with us. So we're looking forward to a great week. But Eben, first, I want to thank you for filling in for me today. And I did want to take just a moment to speak to this issue because it's quite significant. And it's consistent with what this administration has been doing, especially Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, who is really seeking to bring human rights to the forefront, and it begins with a definition. Now, we've seen this administration under President Trump advancing religious freedom internationally, and I'm honored to serve on the USERF Commission in that capacity of advancing religious freedom. But that is articulated very clearly in the 1948 Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Section 18 speaks to religious freedom. But when you look at inalienable rights, what's happened since World War II is that it's been expanded beyond what one would identify as God-granted, rooted in nature, evident of themselves. And what happens when everything becomes a fundamental human right, then nothing is a fundamental human right. And this is going to, there's going to be some controversy, Evan, surrounding this, because there are those that want to deny the fact that we have a creator who endowed men and women with these rights and is the sustainer of those rights. And so as a result, what they've tried to do is create, their own version of inalienable rights granted by government. But we know governments change. So this is what's so important about this, is getting back to the bedrock of what a human right is. And it's going to inform and help shape our foreign policy. So I think this is a very, very significant announcement today.
Well, you know, Tony, one of the things that we hear about oftentimes is with respect to some of these human rights commissions, particularly those under the auspices of the United Nations, you get some human rights, big time human rights abusers like China, Iran, Cuba, and so forth. And somehow they weasel their way onto these commissions, and it's almost laughable. I mean, how do you deal with that?
Yeah, absolutely true. And again, what's happened when you go back to what is really a benchmark when it comes to fundamental human rights is the 1948 Universal Declaration. And that's been lost. And I think this is a chance to bring that to the forefront because, you know, words have meaning. And it's important that we have the right definitions and we're all working with these definitions. And as you point out, when China, Iran, and these other countries can be, you know, on these human rights commissions, it is laughable. But what's so dangerous about this is that fundamental human rights, the right to life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, those things are lost. And this is leadership. Now, it's not without controversy. Leadership, you know, it attracts controversy. But President Trump, with the guidance, with the leadership at the State Department of Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, are leading out in something that I believe is going to be quite significant and bringing us back to a really true north when it comes to what is a fundamental human right. This is an important moment, I think, in American leadership.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, some of those other countries I mentioned, obviously, their definition of human rights are quite malleable and they float around. And again, if it's based on the state, boy, look out, because you're in trouble. When it's based on God, on rights granted by God, that makes all the difference. And how will the establishment of this commission on what's called the Commission on Unalienable Rights, how do you think it's going to further protection of religious freedom?
Evan, that's a great question, but I want to hit on something that you touched on there, which is quite significant, and I really think could be at the center of this. And you said rights created by or given to us by God. Those rights cannot be taken from us by governments legitimately. They are to be protected by government. They're not granted to us by government. And that, as we've lost that understanding, that is what has devalued those rights. So I think a part of what this commission will do is go back to the very bedrock of America, our Declaration, our Constitution, and talk about what these unalienable rights are and the fact that they are not given to us by government. They are rights that we see in nature from nature's God, as the founder said. And I think that makes some on the left uncomfortable because, again, it points to a creator. But this is an important moment of recalibrating what it means to defend human rights literally around the world. So a big, significant step, I think, by this administration.
Oh, very good. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. So many other questions that I could ask you, Tony. When you get back, to the rest of the states back here. I'm sure you're going to be spending more time on that. So thanks again, Tony. Enjoy the rest of that cruise. You're listening to Washington Watch. Eben Fowler here with Bot Radio Network filling in for Tony. Coming up next, I'll talk about Amazon's decision to ban the books by the late Dr. Joseph Nicolosi, who helped people overcome unwanted same-sex attraction. Peter Sprigg, FRC Senior Fellow of Policy Studies, will join me. Don't go away.
In states like New York, Virginia, and Vermont, radical legislation has been written legalizing abortion late in pregnancy, when babies can feel pain and are able to live outside the womb.
Happy birthday to you.
They've gone even further, repealing protections of infants born alive, allowing killing even after birth.
Happy
Congress has yet to protect the life of every newborn baby. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com to send Nancy Pelosi a newborn hat to show Congress every new life should be welcomed with warmth and love, not hate, not death. End birthday abortions. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com.
Happy birthday to you.
Paid for by Family Research Council.
There is unprecedented religious persecution around the globe. In recent years, research has found increasing governmental and social hostility towards religious believers worldwide. For the last 10 years, Christians have been harassed in more countries, including the United States, than any other religious group. While the specific threats to religious freedom vary in type and intensity, one common source is the legal and cultural support for apostasy, blasphemy, and anti-conversion laws, which often threaten the freedom to choose or change one's faith. In a new publication from Family Research Council, we list which nations around the world have these unjust laws on the books and spotlight people who have faced severe penalties simply for sharing or changing their faith. For more information on religious hostility due to apostasy, blasphemy, and anti-conversion laws around the world, visit frc.org/ABA laws. That's frc.org/ABA laws.
You're listening to Washington Watch. Eben Fowler with Bot Radio Network filling in for Tony Perkins today. Tony is on that Alaska cruise. Maybe you can catch that one next time if you're not on it. If you're listening, you're probably not on it. Well, after mounting pressure from homosexual activists, Amazon has removed English language books by the late Dr. Joseph Nicolosi, who helped people overcome unwanted same-sex attraction. Joining me now is Peter Sprigg. He is Family Research Council's Senior Fellow of Policy Studies. Peter, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Thank you for having me.
So, Dr. Nicolosi died a couple of years ago. Why is it that the homosexual activists are just now pressuring Amazon to censor? And I underline and bold that word censor because that's what's going on his books.
Right. Well, there has been this mounting attack upon sexual orientation change efforts, or what the LGBT activists refer to as conversion therapy, although none of the therapists who do it call it that. It's become really extreme in a number of ways. In this case, it appears from one of the reports I've seen that it was not even a group of LGBT activists. It was a single LGBT activist who led the effort to try to get Amazon to remove these books, someone named Rojo Allen, and finally succeeded. So it's interesting that the LGBT movement wields such power that they are able to persuade a huge corporation. One single activist is able to persuade a huge corporation to remove a whole set of books. I'm pretty certain that nobody at Amazon has cracked the cover of any of these books and looked to see what's inside. I doubt that Rojo Allen himself has ever looked at any of these books to see what's inside. And he might be surprised if he did, because the content is not the kind of extreme material that LGBT activists always associate with what they call conversion therapy.
Well, tell us a little bit about Dr. Nicolosi. Who was he, and how did he get involved in this therapy?
Dr. Nicolosi was a psychologist, a PhD-level psychologist, who was one of the founders of the organization called NARTH, the National Association for Research and Therapy of Homosexuality, which has since been renamed the Alliance for Therapeutic Choice and Scientific Integrity. And he was the also the founder of what he called reparative therapy for homosexuality. That term was often misunderstood because people unfortunately thought, you know, oh, he's saying that homosexuals are broken and the therapist has to repair them. Actually, from having heard him speak a number of times, I know that his concept, his framework that he worked from was that homosexuality itself represents a reparative drive, an effort to repair some deficit that existed for the individual in childhood, in particular, a poor relationship with their same-sex parent of a boy with his father, or with the same-sex peers, and that the homosexual attractions develop as a result of this psychological effort to repair this deficit in childhood. And so that if that need can be met in some other way, then the need, quote unquote, for homosexual attractions and homosexual relationships can go away. That was the theory that Dr. Nicolosi worked on. Now, some of his successors, because of the misunderstanding of the term reparative therapy, have used the term reintegrative therapy or sexual attraction fluidity exploration in therapy. But I knew Dr. Nicolosi personally from having attended a number of these conferences. He was a wonderful man, very compassionate man, very committed to the well-being of his clients. And it's very unfortunate to see the attacks being made upon his legacy as well as upon this whole field of counseling.
Now, we've got time for about one more question here, Peter. You know, a lot of his critics claim that that the therapy and that the counseling that he did was pseudoscientific. What's your take on that?
Well, the fact is there have been a number of publications. There have been peer-reviewed scientific studies that have shown that this therapy can be effective. So anytime you hear an LGBT activist say there's no research showing it works, that's a lie. There is research showing it works, and you can find it on the FRC website, in fact, a summary of that. And he also found that the claims of harm have not been borne out. And among Dr. Nicolosi's clients and a study he did himself, very few reported any level of harm at all, and when they did, it was very minor. So both of these key claims of the attacks upon therapy are simply false and have been disproven by Dr. Nicolosi's work itself.
Well, since Amazon has decided to censor this, kind of like Nazi Germany when they burned books, very quickly, how can people get access to Dr. Nicolosi's work?
Well, that's a good question. You might look up the Alliance for Therapeutic Choice. They might have a link to something like that. That's the only way that I know of that I can think of.
Well, that is unfortunate. Peter Sprigg.
But they should contact Amazon and tell them to change their mind.
There you go. There's a great idea. So Peter Sprigg, FRC Senior Fellow of Policy Studies, thanks so much. You're listening to Washington Watch. Eben Fowler with Bot Radio Network filling in today for Tony Perkins. Coming up in our last segment, I'll talk about the new book, Justice on Trial, The Kavanaugh Confirmation, and the Future of the Supreme, with authors Molly Hemingway and Carrie Severino. We'll learn a little bit about what happened behind the scenes. It's a fascinating story. You won't want to miss it. Stick with us. We'll be right back after this break.
Did you know that babies survive failed abortions? Sadly, many of these babies are denied their human right to life and are allowed to die. Currently, there is no federal criminal statute in place to protect these babies after they are born alive. Congress and state legislatures across the country have responded by putting forth legislation to protect infants who survive abortion. However, leftist politicians have blocked efforts in Congress and in state legislatures to pass the Born Alive Abortion Survivors Protection Act, which requires that life-saving medical care be given to babies born alive after failed abortion attempts. We must decide as a country where we stand on the issue of infanticide, to either pursue humane protections for those most vulnerable in our society, or continue to subject innocent human life to the whims of abortionists. For more information, visit frc.org/bornalive. Today, military personnel are at greater risk than ever of suffering from a mental health condition. On average, 21 active and retired military members take their own lives every day. Richard Gleason, a military and veteran advocate in the area of mental health, recently shared evidence that faith-based solutions can help stop this crisis. Here's what Richard had to say.
There's new science out that they watch people while they're praying or have a religious relationship. The frontal part of their brain, if I'm correct in remembering what they told me, it strengthens it. It reduces depression, reduces anxiety and stress while you're doing it. So not only did God give us prayer as a way to alleviate our spirit, it also alleviates our mind and our bodies. Our bodies react in a positive way to a faith-based relationship.
Visit frc.org/speakers to hear more.
Did you know that thanks to President Trump, abortion giant Planned Parenthood can no longer receive up to $60 million in federal funding? This new federal protection for the unborn is thanks to a rule change that the Trump administration implemented to the Title X Family Planning Grant Program, which will take effect in May 2019. Not only do the new Title X rule changes take funding away from our nation's largest abortion supplier, they also ensure that taxpayer dollars are not used for abortion and open the door for pro-life pregnancy resource centers and other faith-based organizations to apply for Title X funds, thus expanding the health care options of needy families who are experiencing unexpected pregnancies. For more information about the new Title X rule changes that protect the unborn and increase health care options, visit frc.org/Title X. That's frc.org/Title X.
Welcome back to this last segment of Washington Watch on this Monday. Eben Fowler with Bot Radio Network, filling in today for Tony Perkins. And, you know, we remember we heard from Tony from that Alaskan cruise talking about this Declaration of Inalienable Rights and the commission that's been formed. We're going to take your calls during this segment, 866-372-7234. If you'd like to comment or talk about any of the segments that we've had, including what took place on the 4th of July, or either of the other two topics, would love to hear from you. 866-372-7234. Our topic in this final segment is the Brett Kavanaugh hearing. Going to set that up a little bit. In the moments before his make-or-break appearance before the Senate Judiciary Committee to dispute allegations of sexual assault in high school, then Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh was getting sharply conflicting advice. Some advisors and friends were urging Kavanaugh to embrace George W. Bush-like restraint in pushing back. Others recommended a full-throated Trump-esque denial. After one aide on that September 2018 day of his testimony suggested that Kavanaugh be gentle in talking about accuser Christine Blasey Ford's allegations, a fired-up White House counsel, Don McGahn, demanded that everyone leave the Capitol Hill War Room where the nominee was doing his prep work. "Everyone," McGahn shouted, even prompting Kavanaugh's wife, Ashley, to get up. That is, before being told she could stay. So these and the other newly reported details about Kavanaugh's fiery confirmation process are included in the forthcoming book. It's called Justice on Trial. the Kavanaugh confirmation, and the future of the Supreme Court. It was written by, or it has been written by, Molly Hemingway and Carrie Severino, and working to get them on the line now, and hopefully we'll be able to talk with them. But, you know, in the meantime, if you watched the Kavanaugh hearings, I did. In fact, I made a point of trying to watch every minute of it. It was historical, and it was a kind of a circus, if you'll remember. I'd like to hear from you, 866-372-7234, and we can talk about your thoughts about that hearing and about the whole Supreme Court nomination and hearing process. Let me read a few reviews that have been written about this book that I just mentioned by Molly Hemingway and Carrie Severino. First of all, this is Randy Barnett, Georgetown Law School. He says, an amazingly well-sourced, behind-the-scenes chronicle of a Supreme Court nomination process that became a national circus. Everyone concerned with how broken the judicial confirmation process has become needs to read this riveting blow-by-blow account. This comment about the book by Robert H. Bork, Jr., a riveting inside look at the nasty politics of character assassination that have plagued the confirmation process going back to my father, Robert H. Bork. And then Marianne Glendon, who is with Harvard University, said, it's hoped that this fine, even-handed book will help to bring an end to the political savagery that's characterized all too many Supreme Court confirmation hearings. And a couple of others, Justice on Trial, that's the name of the book again, reads like a John Grisham novel filled with intrigue and well-paced plot development that's a roller coaster ride even if we know how it ends. This is destined to become the definitive account of a crucial episode in American life. Edwin Meese III, he was the 75th United States Attorney General, said the author's deep knowledge of the players and the constitutional stakes shines throughout the book and makes for a thrilling and revealing read. So, you know, again, we're looking forward, hopefully, to getting the authors, the co-authors, Molly Hemingway, and just heard that we did. Molly Hemingway and Carrie Severino, who wrote this book. It's called Justice on Trial, the Kavanaugh Confirmation and the Future of the Supreme Court. Welcome, ladies, to Washington Watch.
It is great to be here with you.
All right. Are you both on the same phone line?
We are.
All right. This is a little conference call going on here. Well, I just spent the last couple of minutes while we were getting you on the line here talking about reading some of the comments, some of the reviews, including one by Robert Bork, Jr., who said a riveting inside look at the nasty politics of character assassination that's plagued the confirmation process going back to his father, Robert Bork. Well, tell us, first of all, and either one of you, you can fight over who's going to respond first. Tell us why you wrote this book. Then we'll start getting into some of the details that I think are fascinating.
Yeah, so we wrote this book because we realized this was really the most important thing that happened to this country last year. It was not just a trial for Brett Kavanaugh, but justice itself was really on trial and concepts of rule of law and the presumption of innocence. We knew that it would be really important to tell that story because, you know, me as someone who clerked for Justice Thomas, I definitely felt like we have seen this movie before. We know how this playbook ends. And with Justice Thomas, what happened is, even though by a large majority, 2-1 Americans at the time of his confirmation thought that he was credible and Anita Hill was not, we think those numbers have flipped because of a decades-long campaign of disinformation in the media talking about and really lying about what happened in that confirmation process. We want to stop that revisionist history in its tracks right now, and we felt the best way to do that would be to have the definitive story of what really did happen. So we spoke to more than 100 people from the president, many members of the White House, many Supreme Court justices, senators, huge numbers of people who were involved in this process so that we really could tell the definitive story and make sure that Americans know what happened. I think that's the best way to prevent this from repeating.
Very good. Well, let me also say Molly is a writer at the Federalist website and also a Fox News contributor. Carrie is the chief counsel of the Conservative Judicial Crisis Network. Sorry, I didn't get that slipped in there beforehand. But let's dive into some of the behind-the-scenes content. I know, and as I mentioned to our listeners, I watched that entire hearing, was fascinated by it. But based on some of the notes here I have about the book, there's a whole lot more behind the story. So first of all, let me ask you this question. You detail in the book how Judge Kavanaugh tore up his planned opening remarks the day before the hearing. Why did he do that?
Well, Carrie and I both worked. I was covering the confirmation process. Carrie was working on it. We thought we knew a lot about what was going on, but we were kind of blown away by what we learned as we interviewed all these people. One of the scenes that we did think was most interesting was how now Justice Kavanaugh came to deliver his remarks, and he actually worked on his speech quite a bit. What was happening in those days right before he came out to testify? You know, it had gone from kind of a vague allegation that was sort of difficult to even discuss into increasingly outlandish allegations. He was being accused of being a serial rapist, and he was having to deal with this all playing out in front of his children. So as this was getting closer to his testimony, he was getting more and more understandably upset, and I think that really came through in his testimony.
Absolutely. One of the highlights, or the lowlights, if you will, was the interchange with Senator Sheldon Whitehouse. Do you all remember that?
Oh, yes.
Senator Whitehouse made an absolute fool out of himself, as did a number of the other people there. Let me ask you, though, what was the mood, do you think, of the American people at the time? And do you think they believed Christine Blasey Ford's accusations against Kavanaugh?
Well, one of the interesting things that we reported in our book is that one high-profile person, Melania Trump, apparently said to her husband afterwards, "You know this woman's lying, don't you?" And we thought that was so interesting, not just because, you know, this is the first lady saying it, but because it's something that we heard repeatedly. There were a lot of women across America who had that response, and it just didn't ring true to them. And it was something that was so underreported. Many of the media were simply ignoring this side of the story. And that was one of the things that we really reveal. We do a lot of discussion of the role the media played almost as a PR firm for the accuser in this case, and trying to think through ways to regain the American confidence in the media, which I think would mean having to play a much more balanced role in future nominations.
Well, we haven't heard much from Blasey Ford recently, and I imagine there's a reason for that. But here's a question I've got. Is there any legal action that can or should be taken against her or any of these other false accusers?
Well, there was action taken. The Senate Judiciary Committee ended up making a criminal referral of Michael Avenatti and his accuser, Julie Swetnick, which has not yet acted on by the Department of Justice. But it's important, and again, that this came out of Grassley's committee really speaks to how frustrated they were with false allegations, because that's Charles Grassley is known as the guy who is very good with whistleblowers and with harassment victims and whatnot. They understood that what was happening with the Kavanaugh confirmation was an abuse of some very important processes the country has in place to protect whistleblowers and to protect people who are victims of abuse. And so particularly with the more egregious claims, they did make criminal referrals, and they wanted to send a message that these things are so serious, you need to make sure that you have evidence to support outlandish claims, and not to just go with them and not think about how it can destroy people's lives.
Okay, well, Judge Kavanaugh wasn't the only one angry with Democrats on the Senate Judiciary Committee. Republican Lindsey Graham was especially hot under the collar. Bobby, go ahead and roll the sound clip from Senator Graham, if you
would. What you want to do is destroy this guy's life, hold this seat open, and hope you win in 2020. You've said that, not me. You've got nothing to apologize for. When you see Sotomayor and Kagan, tell them that Lindsey said hello, because I voted for them. I would never do to them what you've done to this guy. This is the most unethical sham since I've been in politics.
Now, in the book, you talk about some special edits that Senator Graham made with a black Sharpie. What were those edits, and why did he put them in there?
Well, the edits that we were talking about were Judge Kavanaugh's edits to his own thing. And that was really interesting, because we all remember, I mean, Senator Graham's speech is so moving, but I think one of the really moving things about Judge Kavanaugh's introductory remarks was when he talked about his daughter, Liza, praying for Christine Blasey Ford. And that's something that actually he didn't even know that story until he was on his way to the hearing that morning, because that was a prayer that she and Ashley, his wife, had prayed the night that she she told the girls about these allegations. And when she told him, she said, I think this is something you need to include. And he added that with his Sharpie to the manuscript of the speech that he read. And I think that was such a wise thing to include, because I think it touched so many people across America and reminded us of the human cost involved here.
Yeah, and that was a wonderful moment, and just it showed the character of his family, of his daughter. That was such a neat moment. Well, you interviewed more than 100 people, and that including President Trump, senators, Supreme Court justices. What are a few of the most surprising things you learned from those interviews?
We had so much fun doing these interviews, but one of the things that we thought was so interesting was how, for many of these people, we learned just the amount of courage it took for them to go through this process. Beginning first and foremost, I think it's important to note, with President Trump. We had a lot of people talk to us who had worked in other administrations, who were familiar with other administrations, who said with cause that no other president would have stood by a nominee at a time like this. But also, as we, we're talking about Ashley Kavanaugh. This is a woman who she actually prayed that her husband would not be nominated, because she'd gone through horrible confirmation hearings with him before. And she just, they had a good life and she didn't want to necessarily go through it again. But once he gets the nomination, she commits herself to prayer once again and becomes also a source of support for other people. That took a lot of courage. And it was just humbling to learn these stories, through this this access that we got to learn more about some of these people and what they went through.
That's great. Well, the number is 866-372-7234. If you have a question for either of these ladies, Molly or Carrie, you can call 866-372-7234. Well, after the hearing, Kavanaugh took some phone calls, one from President Trump and former President George W. Bush. What did you learn about those two calls?
Well, it was so interesting to see the contrast between he was someone who had an incredibly close relationship with President Bush. I mean, he worked in the highest levels in the Bush White House. Ashley was Bush's personal secretary. She was the one sitting right out front of the Oval Office, having a very involved relationship with him. So President Bush, it was a very close family friend. He even hosted a wedding party when they were married in the Rose Garden. So that's how close they were. And then, of course, President Trump, a very different personality, right? A very different style. And that was one of the challenges of this nomination, trying to figure out how to bridge those two things. I think he had a lot of friends around him giving advice who were people who had worked in the Bush administration, who had a kind of different approach to the people who were now in the Trump administration. There was a moment, and we talked a little bit about as he was getting ready for his opening statement at that final hearing, where White House counsel Don McGahn, who also really shares a lot of the credit for doing an amazing job of bringing this across the finish line, having a great team at the White House counsel's office. And he said to him, "You're a Trump nominee. Like, you need to go out there and fight, and particularly when you're having someone, not just your judicial qualifications, not just your professional capacity, but your personally, your character and your reputation on the line." It was so key that he came out and showed that fighting spirit and the passion that he was feeling about that.
And to that point, and we have just a little bit less than a minute, you document that Kavanaugh's advisors were split on how he should approach that day. Why do you think McGahn and his side won out?
Well, one of the things that happened for the Justice Kavanaugh was having that interview with Martha McCallum.
Sorry, I'm losing you there. Can you speak up just a second? Oh, I guess we have lost our guests. Well, we're at the end of the program. The book is called Justice on Trial, The Kavanaugh Confirmation and the Future of the Supreme Court. Make sure you look for a copy. If you're interested in this topic, you'll definitely want to read that. Justice on Trial, The Kavanaugh Confirmation and the Future of the Supreme Court. Eben Fowler sitting in today on Washington Watch for Tony Perkins. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next time.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is powered by the Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.